right, let's call the joint committee meeting together, joint judiciary committee. Today, we convene jointly to look at the Alaska State Task Force on Human Trafficking, Promoting Prostitution and Sex Trafficking. We'll have the Attorney General in a moment, but before we do, Representative Keller, why don't you go ahead and notice your members present.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Representative Lance Pruitt, Representative Bob Lynn, myself, Representative Wes Keller, and Representative Neil Foster are with us today.
And with us today, we have Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Wilkowski, Senator and Vice Chair, or no, yeah, Vice Chair, McGuire.
What's her name?
Senator Coghill. It's too early to have senior moments, so it's pre-senior.
Rick Perry moment.
Sorry about that. Before us is the Attorney General of the State of Alaska, and they've been working in this task force, and welcome before us, their Attorney General, and thank you for taking this responsibility on and coming together with this report. I know you have those that will be testifying with you, so why don't you take the floor?
Thank you to both chairmen. My name is Mike Garrity. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Alaska. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about the work of the task force. Just as an overview, one of the task force members will be testifying telephonically today from Bethel, and one has traveled down here from Anchorage to testify live, but I'd like all the task force members to participate a little bit in this presentation because we've all worked very hard and contributed a great deal towards its results, but we will break it up and try to keep it brief as we move through it, and then we'll be deferring to the legislature for further action. But the task force to study sex trafficking and human trafficking was created by a bill introduced in 2012 by Senator McGuire, Senate Bill 212. The purpose was to evaluate the number of human and sex trafficking cases reported to law enforcement and investigated by the police since 2007, the number that were prosecuted under state law, the number of cases investigated in cooperation with municipal and federal authorities, and the services available to victims of these crimes. The task force was also asked to make recommendations for improving services to victims. Senate Bill 212 was later merged with SB 210 and passed both the Senate and the House by unanimous votes. And the report we present today is the result of the work by that task force. The members of the task force, and I'm going to ask each to, when they come up, to talk a little bit more about themselves and their interest in this area and their background as it relates to the task force, were Commissioner Joe Masters from Department of Public Safety, Commissioner Bill Struer from the Department of Health and Human Services, and his Deputy Commissioner Reese Sailors is here today and served as his delegate and, for most of the hearings. Gwen Adams from Anchorage and Michelle DeWitt from Bethel. The task force met a total of 7 times. A couple of those were telephonic as we approached the end of our deliberations. We had 3 public hearings, one in Anchorage that lasted several hours in November, one in Bethel, and then while we were in Bethel, we hopped on a plane, courtesy of public safety, and flew out to Hooper Bay and also had a hearing out there in that village. And the commission had done, the great deal of research had been done by my staff at the Department of Law already, and I also want to give an acknowledgement to the First Lady Sandy Parnell, who's had a deep and abiding interest in the subject and approached the Cook Inlet Tribal Council some point last year, I think in the spring after the bill was passed, that conducted kind of its own investigation. And I give a lot of credit to Cook Inlet Tribal Council and the work that they've done with the participation of the First Lady. They plowed some of this ground and gave us some research and some avenues to pursue on our own. So we owe them a debt of gratitude as well.
Attorney General, I'm just going to notice that Gabrielle Adu has joined us, and Charisse Millett.
Thank you,
representatives, for showing up. We're right at the beginning of the introduction to the presentation by the Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But in any event, as I said, I came to this as a new Attorney General, number one, but number two, as a person that did not have much background or knowledge about this, and so it's been an eye-opening experience for me. I had the deputy, my deputy, Rick Svobodi, the criminal division, was also involved as a kind of a surrogate and participated in the hearings. But it's an issue that's like domestic violence, I think, has been kind of swept in the dark corners of our society. And it's really, you know, the fundamental mindset is the notion that prostitutes are really not criminals. They're really victims in the grand scheme of things, and we as a society and as a government, I think, have to change the way we think about that. And so that's the fundamental mental shift, I think, that I came to grips with, and as somebody who was new to the subject and wanted to learn a lot about it. And we did solicit a lot of testimony from local law enforcement, from the FBI, from NGOs and other groups who are involved in providing to these victims and others. So it's been a tremendous experience for me, and one that was very valuable. At this time, I want to move on and ask Commissioner Masters and Deputy Commissioner Saylors to step forward and talk a little bit about their perspective, briefly, and what they, their interest in this area, obviously, and turn to them for a short preliminary statement as well.
All right. Thank you, Attorney General. And please step forward, Commissioner Masters and Deputy Commissioner Reese Saylors. Thank you for coming before us, and we look forward to your testimony. Just put yourself on the record first, and in order, however you want to do it.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, and I am also one of the sitting members of the commission. The Attorney General laid out some basic information regarding some shifts in thought and how we deal with things. And my role on the committee was to bring a law enforcement perspective to the discussion, and at the same time, see how it relates to how we deal with sex trafficking and human trafficking from the law enforcement perspective, but also to take a look to see how things can or may be improved in this area as well. One of the significant things that I can say is that I wasn't necessarily thoroughly prepared for the level of change in thought on the matter. And and I think those that become more and more immersed in learning about sex trafficking, human trafficking, probably would certainly agree. Now, there's a couple of points that I wanted to lay out.
Before you get started on that, Commissioner, I just wanted to notice that Max Gruenberg had joined us. Thanks, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Masters. Please continue.
And there was just a couple of things I wanted to note that I thought was significant in this process of the work. And that is, until recently, the crimes of human trafficking and sex trafficking have largely been misunderstood, overlooked, and underestimated due to the underground and hidden nature of these crimes. And I'd say that my thought and belief is that there is probably not a single crime that we investigate that is more underground and more hidden and not reported than this specific set of crimes. I would also say that in more recent years, the FBI and the Anchorage Police Department have probably taken a very strong or lead role in the issue, and in the remaining agencies in the state, I believe, are largely ill-equipped and largely untrained to recognize and respond to trafficking, and victims are often viewed as offenders, and this has got to shift, or the thinking has to shift. Also, that victims view themselves as the offenders in many cases. Victims, including youth, are ensnared in sex and labor trafficking, and they may feel that they are consenting to the exploitation or don't have better options. That the social and cultural stigmas and stereotypes associated with prostitution present additional barriers for victims as well. And this makes reporting unlikely and cooperation with law enforcement even more difficult. For these and many reasons, the abuse, exploitation, and trafficking of our most vulnerable citizens, children, present us with many unique challenges. And it's also my firm belief that as we move forward, that effective investigations must involve proactive enforcement and strong collaborations with other agencies, victim service providers, and even the victims themselves. Those were some of the main points that I garnered as we went through. And I'll be talking more about some of the recommendations when we get into that portion of the presentation.
And as we have your testimony and Ms. Saylor's testimony, I wanted to kind of get them to lay it out first, and then we can go into some of the recommendations. So are you done, Commissioner?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you right at the last sentence, so I didn't. All right. So Deputy Commissioner Saylor's.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ree Saylor's. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to make a few brief remarks. The first thing I'd like to say is, as you receive this report in the appendices, there are transcripts of the testimony given. And I would like to commend those to you because they are courageous, profound, and very thought-provoking, and I think they speak as eloquently as any of us could to the problem and to the challenge that we have before us. The Department of Health and Social Services, we see victims of human trafficking in a variety of our programs, or we see the potential victims of human trafficking in a lot of our services, too. One of the connections that was made is there is a much higher risk to become a victim of trafficking if a child experiences childhood trauma. And you will hear a lot, I think this session, in a variety of places talking about trauma-informed care. And I think what has been a breakthrough has been what science has brought us in terms of understanding how the brain develops and what trauma does to that brain development, not only in a temporary fashion, but potentially in a very permanent fashion, and certainly in a very detrimental fashion. So part of what we as a department learned sitting in on this, and I think we learned a lot, was that it, first of all, it gave us the opportunity to deepen our understanding of trafficking, too. Much like the previous speakers, I think we had plenty to learn and more depth to dive in terms of this issue. We also saw that we have opportunities to improve our prevention efforts in order to decrease the impact of trauma and to intervene early and quickly. The other things that I like to talk about, these opportunities, because they are challenges, but the opportunities to consider how we might better serve those who are caught in the snare of trafficking, and to examine how we can better coordinate the services that we have and the millions of dollars of services that we finance through the state of Alaska and the department, not only through our direct programs, but through our grantee programs as well. And to explore opportunities and services for these victims that include their need for residential care, housing, homes, to look at our foster care system to see if there's a way for us to create an augmented set of foster parents who can understand the difficulties that these kids have been through and afford them therapeutic foster care. I think also we have, you know, our child welfare system, our juvenile justice system, our public health system, our early learning, our infant learning programs, and our public assistance programs, all of which can come to bear for these victims. And I think part of our lesson is learning how to better coordinate and focus those in response to when we see a victim of trafficking. It has also reinforced our investment in trauma-informed care. You have provided, as the legislature, you have provided funding in the past for the Office of Children's Services and for the Division of Juvenile Justice. And one of the interesting things about the Division of Juvenile Justice is that they did a pilot in McLaughlin, training the staff there about trauma-informed care, and have taken it deeper, I think, to try and find ways to understand the implications. If you understand trauma-informed care, how do you change the way you operate a facility? How do you change the way your staff interacts with the people who are there? And also, juvenile justice is often seen as the place that is the residential treatment lockup kind of place. However, there are many programs in the juvenile justice system that deal with probation and early intervention. And so I think we're also trying to move all of that training into there. We have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars training behavioral health providers in this state on trauma-informed care, and we hope to see and harvest the benefit of those investments as well and continue to make those investments as we go forward. We're also looking at intake instruments at juvenile justice and elsewhere so that we can try and tease out victims of trafficking, kids who aren't always forthcoming with this. We see them for other reasons related to maybe law enforcement charges. However, as we work with them and gain their trust, they're willing to reveal that they have indeed been the victim of human and sex trafficking. We also know that based on what we've learned from the task force, that we, in conjunction, have a lot more to learn and a lot more to do. And with that, I would commit on behalf of Commissioner Struer and the department our continued commitment to working on this as we go forward in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And we have online, we have with us Michelle DeWitt as well. And before we go into a discussion, what I'd like to do is have all these members go ahead and present. And so if that's fine with you, I'd like to go ahead and have Michelle. And Michelle, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Michelle, you actually get to have the floor, so introduce yourself by not only name but participation in why you are involved in this task force. And then give us your report.
My name is Michelle DeWitt. My last name is spelled D-E-W-I-T-T. Mm-hmm. And I live in Bethel, and I appreciate being able to join the task force for today's presentation. I'm the director of Tender Women's Coalition here in Bethel, serving the YK region of Southwest, the Southwest portion of our state. And our organization is providing services to domestic violence and sexual assault victims. This was an honor to be invited to join this task force and represent, in particular, rural Alaskans in our state, and to help provide a rural perspective to the task force. Briefly, and I'll speak again later in the task force's presentation, but briefly I'd like to mention a couple of things that really were pointed out to me throughout the education process that I received as being part of this task force. And one is the connection between trauma and trauma impacts and people who experience trafficking. A number of presentations that we attended or presenters we heard from spoke about risk factors for folks who are recruited into trafficking, and some of the studies we read about and such also looked at some of those risk factors. So it really hit home how children who experience sexual abuse, people who experience homelessness, all of these kinds of traumas can work together to create some vulnerabilities that traffickers are then able to exploit in the recruiting process. So that was something that really stuck out to me. Something else that stuck out, which I'll speak about a bit later, was how the issue of human trafficking can be masked as other things, such as domestic violence or possibly sexual assault, and how people present to service providers, it can be very difficult to tell initially that the person you're working with has experienced trafficking. As a part of being on the task force, I had people approach me who were concerned about loved ones who they had believed or had been recruited into trafficking. And two or three different individuals reached out to me as having had experienced trafficking in the past. And a couple of those folks are folks who had received services, and I hadn't identified them as trafficking victims. Our agency hadn't identified them as trafficking victims, in particular because of how people present. So those are some things that really stuck out to me as part of being on the task force. And I've said this to several folks, I think what was notable about this process was the amount of education that many of us still need, that Alaskans, I think, still need on this issue, and how reframing trafficking and re-educating ourselves about what that is and what it looks like can really, I think, bring some of this issue out of the shadows where it's hidden. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your participation also, Michelle, and thank you for your work and your Women's Coalition there. So I'm going to go on to Gwen, and why don't you go ahead and just tell us your part in this and what brings you to this task force, and then give us your report.
My name is Gwen Adams, and I'm in women's ministry at Change Point in Anchorage, and we began to put together a nonprofit group called Priceless and began to reach out to victims of sexual trafficking and sexual slavery because we noticed an increasing number of them coming through our doors. I think for me, my heart was really broken and turned towards this issue in a way that I wanted to step in with both feet for two different women. They never met each other until more recently, but their stories were so similar, and they kept me up at night for a long time. One of them, simply because I had her in a class that I was teaching for 6 months, and there would be no outward sign to understand the horror that she was living with. For 13 years, she was held captive as a sexual slave, being sold to the family that she lived with, who pretended to be her foster parents, being sold to pay the mortgage. I asked her if she had any, if she was being held captive, or if she was participating in this against her will, and she said, "No, I have a choice." And I said, "Well, what happens if you would refuse?" She said, "Well, I would be beaten, I wouldn't get to eat, and I would be locked in a closet for days." "So how do you have a choice?" "Well, I can choose to be beaten, or I can choose to have sex." But completely unaware of the fact that she was being trafficked or a victim. She just felt like these were her circumstances in life and had no way out. The other one had also been held captive for about 10 years, well into her adult life. And as she escaped, she chose to hide out and live in the Chugach on her own for 3 months before she would even ever, and wouldn't even go to law enforcement because she felt like nobody would believe her. Nobody. She was so convinced that her traffickers would find her, kill her, and kill her family if she ever said a word about it. And as I got to know these two women and watched a beautiful recovery begin to take place, they needed to learn things like how to take care of a checkbook and learn to read and get a driver's license and how to properly bathe and all of these kind of things. My heart just began to think, how many more are there? And as both of these women have come forward and told their stories, scores of women have approached them and said, "I'm in a similar situation." I think for me, just the fact that this is so hidden and so underground, and you can catch somebody who's got drugs on their person and arrest them for drug charges, but when they've got when they're the product is women and girls and children who refuse to say a word, it's one of those crimes that just easily goes undetected and underground so quickly. And so my heart was wanting to engage. I mean, for me, this is a sanctity of life issue. People cannot be purchased and sold. And that's what's happening in our state. And I am passionate that we, as a state, declare not on our ground. Slavery is not happening here. And we make it a very annoying place for a trafficker to run business, that this becomes hostile territory for our traffickers. So that's why I'm engaged.
That's very compelling. There's no doubt that there are people right now as we speak who are entrapped. And I agree with you. Not on our state, not on our ground, while we can do anything about it. So. Thank you for that very compelling testimony. And the state's resources, the issues that we deal with, we'll do our best to focus it. Before I go into panel discussion, Attorney General, is there any other thing that you wanted to bring forward in rounding out this? So I would like to go into some discussion at this point And the first one I'd like to bring up for the discussion is the very one who actually set this in motion, is Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to thank all the panel members again publicly. I came on the line and thanked all of you in your deliberations and for all the work that you did. And a lot of it was confidential and very heart-wrenching. And I know Amy from my office, I want to thank Amy Saltzman as well for her work. But the testimony that you took and the outreach that each of you did as members, Gwen just gave a really good synopsis of the kind of efforts that each member brought in. I think you all started in the journey with sort of a view of what you would do, and I think that it grew. And it took on a whole life of its own, ending with your recommendation that this become a permanent part of Alaska's structure, that you thought that there were so many things to do that really your work needed to continue. And so I think it became bigger than you even thought it would be. So I thank you for your work and the mission that you had. I've talked with many of you, but the one question that I had when I was looking through here that I hadn't caught before was in the area of expungement, because I thought that was a good recommendation, and I hadn't caught the fact that there were task force members that were concerned about that. And I don't want to call anybody out publicly about those who were concerned about it. Maybe this is a good question for you, Commissioner, without saying who, but what would be the concerns, I guess, about expunging those records? Because I do think that is, when we look at some of the girls that have come forward at Covenant House and others, this is one of the big barriers to finding housing, to finding jobs, to getting your feet back on the ground, as you discussed, Gwen, that barrier to going from victim, I guess you would say, or potential criminal, but really victim, back into to a good life, is having that record expunged. And I would like to say, perhaps first-time John, perhaps a young man that modeled poorly behavior after an elder father figure or uncle or somebody else poorly, and has an opportunity to be retrained, that's not the right way of life either, and gets a chance to expunge that record and go on and live a good life.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I believe I could safely say that it wasn't the discussion wasn't a matter of whether or not there should be some mechanism to clear a victim's record to allow not only healing but also fulfillment of life for that victim. The discussion mainly hung up, I would say, in the area of what the best mechanism to do that would be. As we discussed it, it was a very complex issue on trying to figure out how it could occur, how the mechanism of affording that expungement would take place, how to clear a record, whether or not clearing a record would have other unintended consequences, how to ensure the prostitutes that were not in fact victims of sex trafficking didn't take advantage of that process to continue their work with and get their records cleared. I'm probably not explaining this succinctly as one of my law people might be able to do. But that's where a lot of the discussion really occurred. And it wasn't necessarily a matter of whether it should be done. It's how it could be done. And that was a matter that we felt fairly strongly should be a matter that was, if we were able to continue the work of the task force, either in a formal or informal manner, that would be one of the issues that was taken up.
Why don't we have the Attorney General come and just give us how that question would be framed at this point in our Department of Law. In fact, Attorney General, why don't you just pull up a chair right alongside Commissioner Masters here, and I may end up having a row of eight by the time it's all said and done. We'll see. But so that we can have a free-flowing conversation here. Attorney General, on the question of expungement, and what are the questions we have to ask to get there?
Well, let me just preface that by saying what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, and at your discretion would be to, we're going to have to go through all the recommendations very briefly and have some of the task force members address each one, again, very briefly, a couple of minutes each, just to expand on them. This is the last one, but that the senator brought up, but let me take that up now. As the commissioner pointed out, it wasn't so much a question of for or against it. It was just it came up late in the day, and we didn't have any legislation in front of us. And since then, we did, in several states, not a majority by any means, but a small handful of states have acted in this area, and the state of Washington in particular has both a safe harbor provision and a statute for expunging these records. And so I'd be happy to take up, you know, volunteer to draft a bill for the committee's consideration, and then or work with your staffs to do that. But again, as the commissioner pointed out, we're not against it. It's got a lot of positives for it, but it came up so late in the process, and we were under constraints to get this to the committee that we didn't have concrete recommendations. But I can tell you that since then, I have looked at bills that have been passed in the states, and I think they would work in our state. And they address the kind of issues that the commissioner raised. I mean, people who get multiple, continue to get multiple convictions for prostitution and so on. I mean, not all prostitutes or and as we say, victims that they're arrested for this activity are trafficked, but many are. And so I think, as I said, there has to be some distinguishment drawn into the legislation, and other states have done this. So I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel. I'd be happy to work with your staff, Senator, or the chairman's staff, and come up with a draft legislation to look at.
Under our Senate Bill 22, that question has come up directly. Yes. So we will probably take some thought to that as well.
And I'd be happy to turn over what I've got, the research, to your staffs and let you folks work with it as well. But let me, I hope that answers
Thank
the question.
Very
responsive.
Much.
And as I said, if it's okay with the chairman, at your discretion, let the commissioner start off looking at a couple in order, and then Gwen will come back and talk about a couple as well, and Michelle and as well, and I've got a couple to address.
Right, I'll let you lead the why don't you just stay here, that way we'll just stay in order. We have 55 minutes to move down through these recommendations, so that we don't get wrapped around the axle, I'll allow a question at this point, but
that's okay.
All right. I wanted them to go through the recommendations so that we get to hear their full report as much as possible. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, just a couple of quick things. There's very little in the recommendations that it would direct us to change the law. Most of the things that are here have to do with treating victims and all that sort of thing. So I'm glad for us to have this hearing, and I'm glad for the work, but there's not much here that is for us to do in changing statute law. There are certainly things for us to do in supporting all of the aftercare and transition services and protection services, but they're not a legal issue, and I think that's true. And I just want to note one other thing here. I noticed in the report that there's no police investigations of, quote, human trafficking. And my guess is we have virtually or a very, very small problem in this state with human trafficking. And several of the paragraphs in here that are, I think, are obviously directed to sex trafficking, you know, just say human trafficking. And I think that confuses the issue a little bit. And I don't think the task force has done almost rightly has put much effort into the human trafficking thing, for what it's worth.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dyson.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, through the Senator Dyson, through the chair, I'm not prepared to make that conclusion. I don't, that there is not much human trafficking. We did hear testimony when we were in Bethel from a representative of the Alaska Immigration Justice Project, who talked about a very egregious case where some women from Russia had been solicited to come over for cultural type dancers. You remember this? Mm-hmm. And to come over and they were enticed, and the people approached their parents or anything like that. They ended up coming over, and they ended up working in a topless place. And so it was prosecuted by the feds, in part because I don't think we had the state law or the infrastructure at the time or the awareness. I don't want that to happen again, because it is a violation of state law. It should be prosecuted. But so my point is, I'm not prepared to say you're wrong or right, because these crimes are undercover. It may be a job. There's threats of coercion, of force, of everything else, even of victims of sex trafficking. They may think it's okay, because they don't have much going on in their lives. They don't know that there's something out there for them, potentially, a way to escape this. It may not have gotten brutal yet. It may be in the early stages of the relationship. So there's just a lot we don't know about it, and I hear what you're saying. I would agree that there are a few things that I would recommend for consideration to be changed in the law, but that's not the focus of the recommendations.
Yeah,
I would agree
exactly
with that.
Right.
I would agree with that.
And just for what it's worth, we have 13 recommendations and 45 minutes, basically. So
very quickly. Mr. Chairman, I'll start with the first two, and probably the most important of the recommendations was that we identified as a task force that this work has got to continue, that the issues are much too complex, that some of the solutions that we're discussing would take a lengthy period of time to, and some of them to even flesh out how they may appear, that there needs to be a formal or a vehicle or mechanism by which this group can formally move forward. Some of the main areas in the recommendations are contained within the report, starting on page 22. And the first recommendation is to establish a permanent working group on human and sex trafficking. Some of the main areas that this group would address would be identify ways to improve data sharing on runaways and homeless youth between service providers and the state, evaluate options for reducing demand, and provide recommendations for what demand reduction measures can be implemented, evaluation of ways to promote and expand the availability of shelters for unaccompanied minors, and things of that nature. And that's certainly one of the issues that this task force would continue to do, is look at potential statute changes as well, and particularly in the area the Attorney General talked about, in safe harboring. The second recommendation, which is also equally important, is that there has to be an increased awareness on not only the behalf of the responders, both at the level of law enforcement as well as the service providers that would be assisting victims, but there's also got to be increased awareness on behalf of the public on what sex trafficking is, what it means, what the ramifications are, and also ways to get the word out, for lack of a better way to say it, to get the word out that there is ways that that people can intervene and help victims get out of the situations that they're in, and publicize those ways, including, for example, numbers that victims may call for assistance that would get them directed towards resources. Those are the first two. I'll move on to number three.
Gwen.
Number three is develop mechanism to allow.
Just so that we make sure that the people are transcribing
it. Adams.
Thank you, Gwen.
Develop a mechanism to allow victim advocates access to potential trafficking victims. And through this, we just want to make sure that when somebody's brought in on a prostitution charge, that they have access to somebody who not only understands what the resources are, but can create a safe environment, taking the burden of this off of law enforcement. To give them the best chance to be able to testify. It is critical that the victims come forward and give testimony, or we will not be able to catch the traffickers. And so we need to provide whatever resources law enforcement needs to come alongside these victims. A victim advocate from a private entity would ensure that there's not a conflict with law enforcement or prosecutors taking the victim, and creating an environment where the victim could feel safe and speak openly with a victim advocate and then be pointed towards the services. And this can be done without professionals. These victims advocates would be the ones pointing the victims towards professional services, but just coming alongside of them with some great training on how to help. The next recommendation, number four, is to educate our youth on human and sex trafficking. educating Alaska's youth on the dangers of human trafficking and the process traffickers use to groom and lure their victims is of utmost importance in advancing the state's prevention efforts. The average age of the victims in our state is 15 to 17 years old. Our Alaskan Native women are at special risk, and so we would recommend that there would be two types of education, one for our Alaskan Natives out in the bush and one for the rest of the state. Our Alaskan Native women are at special risk because they're easy to identify and have an exotic look, which is desirable. They have a much higher chance of coming into the profession pre-groomed. In other words, there's a higher percentage of sexual victims in that group. And when brought in, they have a difficult time of getting back to family or safety because it often requires money and a plane ticket home, which they often can't access real quickly. So just providing, thinking, having two separate videos that go out to all of the school systems and just making students aware of what the dangers are. For example, we had one trafficker that was casing the Diamond Mall, passing out cards, going up to young women during for Rondi, asking if they were interested. They were beautiful, and would you be interested in maybe modeling? I have a model agency. So just making students aware of what's really going on and what the dangers are is important. The fifth recommendation is to train law enforcement, DHSS prosecutors, and key service providers, and have a common training for everybody that would give them the tools that they need to identify victims rather than everybody just kind of running off of a different set of plans. The other aspect to training that is critical is the coordination of emergency responses, in which the various agencies and entities know who to call and what to do if a potential victim is identified. The initial training on how to identify victims should be implemented as soon as possible. For example, there was testimony that law enforcement has already begun integrating trafficking into their training. The coordinated emergency response may take some time to develop, but it's vital to ensure an effective response plan.
And moving on, one that we suggested to be looked at, which would require an amendment to the statute, would be to the administrative subpoena law currently allows us to go to internet service providers to find out who is subscribed to a particular internet address, and so in the case of people looking at child pornography and the like. But today, it's something you learn. I mean, now with the internet, people don't troll the streets anymore. You can post a photo of an attractive lady on some of these websites and solicit very indirectly, or even not that indirectly, for whatever services you want. And so we believe it'd be a good idea to amend the administrative subpoena law to allow us to go to these websites, Craigslist, for example. Backpage.com is another one where these types of photos, these services are offered, to try to find out who's checked in to the website, who posted the photograph, who posted the information to begin with, and so on. So that is an area where I think recommend for the committee's consideration that the change in the law could be made. The next one has to do with pretrial diversion programs. It's already been touched upon, but and it's a theme, a recurrent theme throughout this discussion, which is that we have to develop ways to garner the trust of these victims. And if they're simply treated as a criminal and they're arrested for prostitution and thrown into the mill, they're going to get bailed out again right away by their trafficker or pimp, and we've lost them. We heard testimony, very compelling testimony, from the Anchorage Police Department and the FBI, and listened to audio tape of one particular victim and the efforts, the time, and the went into developing a relationship of trust with this person who later was a key witness in a case. It's enormous, and we've got to think outside the box and develop programs so that we just don't throw them into the mill, but we figure out, they're victims. They're not criminals. We've got to change our thinking about it and develop programs that at least put them in a place where we can, hopefully through the previous recommendation Gwen was talking about, develop advocates to work with them, garner their trust, and try to get them out of this life. Then is Michelle. Next, Michelle, would you like to talk about the next three?
Yes, thank you. This is Michelle DeWitt for the record. Our eighth recommendation is to update population and intake surveys to better identify potential trafficking victims. I heard Senator Dyson speak to the scope of the problem and how it appears that the scope could be very small. I'm not sure after participating on the task force that any of us could speak clearly yet about the scope of this problem in Alaska. Much of the testimony and much of the evidence and much of the discussion has been fairly anecdotal in nature. The data that we have is fairly limited to a handful of usually federal criminal investigations in our state. And part of the reason for that is because we don't have another way that we're currently collecting data. Our recommendation is to attempt to integrate questions related to trafficking on a couple of national surveys. One's called BERFIS, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. The other is YRBS, Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System. Another recommendation related to this is to integrate screening questions into law enforcement intake procedures. And a third suggestion would be to incorporate trafficking screening questions as a requirement of certain grants that organizations receive, perhaps grants that are funding certain kinds of human services or victim services, to ensure that intake procedures are including questions that would capture feedback about trafficking. For example, my agency, we're not asking questions of our program participants that would elicit responses about trafficking. As such, we don't know how many folks we're serving have also experienced trafficking. Were we to be asking the right questions, and other organizations and other surveys be asking the right questions, I think we'd have a much better sense of the scope of the problem in Alaska. The ninth recommendation is continual efforts on language access. And this takes on two aspects. One is ensuring that we have proper interpreter services for folks whose primary language is other than English. If the victim can't communicate at a certain level about what they've been experiencing, then there's not going to be an opportunity for investigating agencies or service agencies to discover that this individual is experiencing trafficking and provide proper assistance. The second aspect of this is to help train our first responders on better understanding when an interpreter may be needed. Frequently, because people may have conversational or basic English, it could be misidentified that they do not need an interpreter when, in fact, they need an interpreter to discuss this level of complexity of something they're experiencing. The tenth recommendation is the encouragement of safe shelter, short-term and long-term. It was very clear from participating on this task force that victims of trafficking have long and intensive full range of needs. People who experience trafficking have essentially been fed and sheltered by their trafficker. Their identifying documents have typically been taken by the trafficker. When they present as a victim of trafficking, they need to be able to have a shelter resource, a food resource, clothing resource, an ability to obtain identifying documents, those kinds of services. Whether this means new shelter, this may mean new shelter services, it may mean new partnerships with the faith community or other services, it may mean expanding our capacity in domestic violence and sexual assault shelter services. I think any and each of these are part of our recommendations, but certainly establishing a shelter safety net for trafficking victims will be a key in ensuring that those victims are able to come forward safely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Masters.
Excuse me. This is Joe Masters. And continuing to number 11, and this is an extension of what was just being discussed on the issue of housing. One gap, though, is that there are circumstances where we may have a situation where a minor needs to be put into emergency housing, and we don't have the ability to get consent from the parent, or sometimes the guardian may be part of the issue of who's trafficking the victim. So there's a need to fill this gap and make some determinations of how we can move forward. We didn't have a lot of time to develop this thought out in our committee, and this is something I believe that the task force, if it's continued, can specifically work on. The next one, which is number 12, is develop a hotline and emergency response for the hotline. The key here is that victims, when they are ready to reach out for help, they have the ability to do so and have a mechanism to do so. And currently, we don't necessarily have that. There are a couple of potentials out there. One is a current project, which is the Polaris project, that may be able to fit this need, or it may be that we identify that we need to have a hotline that's specific to Alaska. In either case, though, it's more than just giving a number to somebody to call. Whoever's on the other side of that line has to be trained, but they also have to understand what resources are available to the individual that needs that help. So that was number 12.
And the last recommendation, one I already addressed, Mr. Chairman, which was the evaluate legislation that would allow expungement of the prior prostitution convictions of trafficking victims and also safe harbor provision. So I believe that covers in very cursory fashion all of our recommendations. I want to give my thanks to Commissioner Masters and Deputy Commissioner Sailors and Commissioner Stewart for their participation and support. I also want to personally thank Gwen and Michelle for all their work. I mean, we get paid for this, but these people volunteered their time. It was a great deal of time and a no small sacrifice to serve on this task force, and they brought a very valuable perspective and a lot of passion, we've heard today, to the subject, and it was a pleasure and a privilege to serve with them. Finally, I also want to thank, for the record, Corey Mills, Kathy Satterfield, and Marie Gathens from the Department of Law. And I already mentioned Deputy Svobodny, but they also spent a lot of time, did a lot of research, read a lot, and assisted the task force immensely in doing our work. And they deserve a great deal of credit. But with that, we'll conclude and turn it over to the chairman.
Thank you. Actually made it through those recommendations a lot faster than I thought. So excellent job. I think Gabrielle Ledoux had a question, and then Senator Dyson.
Yes, Attorney General. So when you're considering expungement legislation, and I guess there's some concern that it might pick up prostitutes who were not victims of human trafficking or sex trafficking, I mean, would it be the end of the world if you occasionally picked up somebody who was a prostitute and wasn't a victim of this but was trying to get their life together and you expunged their record too accidentally?
No, it's not the end of the world. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, and I, you know, that's certainly well within the legislature's discretion, and I certainly commend that. I mean, people have made mistakes in life. The question is, there's other mistakes people make in their life, the burglary, other types of petty crimes, and you know, those records typically aren't expunged. So I mean, there's important issues, but to answer your question, no, I don't think that's the end of the world. And the statutes that I've read talk about the burden that the victim has to show, and it's not an overwhelming burden, but there has to be some showing that they were a victim of trafficking somehow. But that could be just, you know, a pimp in many cases, quite honestly. So again, I've studied the legislation in great depth. Again, I'd be happy to work with any of the staff who are interested in this or even draft something that could work in Alaska based upon what other states have done. But to answer your question, that's not the end of the world, and I certainly sympathize with what you're trying to do there.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. My earlier point was that having the phrase human trafficking here with human sexual traffic produces confusion. A couple of the people testifying believe strongly, as I do, about the sex trafficking, but they use the word human trafficking. And mm-hmm. Pardon my being pedantic, but that is confusing things. And I still believe there's almost a minuscule problem of people being trafficked in our state for labor. And the Russians, well, I think dancing topless is a sexual thing, and they were brought here, and it led to prostitution for those very women. And, you know, and that's a problem. I helped a small part in breaking up a trafficking ring. They were all Asian women, you know, and they were brought here under the same kind of thing and were imprisoned right downtown Spinard for months, you know. And that's, but I don't think the labor one is an issue, and I don't think it's within the purview of what Senator McGuire had in mind in putting this together. And I think the task force has rightly concentrated on the sex trafficking. So as my point got made by the people testifying, and also just for the record, one third of the people who are sexually assaulted in our state are little boys. You know, and I don't want us to get zeroed in on just the girls. When I got to this town for this job 16 years ago, little boys were being booked electronically to serve as people coming on cruise ships by computer with the complicity of their parents. You know, horrendous, horrendous issue. And I interviewed several young men who, hockey players and football players, were dancing, if you will, at one of the joints, you know, in South Anchorage. And I said, hey, who hits on you the most, the middle-aged ladies or the men? Invariably, it was the men, you know, that were hitting on us. Now, here's a technical question. I thought trafficking involved transportation. That's what it seems like here in page two. You know, if not, how do we distinguish between a pimp and a trafficker?
Well, I think it can involve transportation. The example that we both mentioned of the dancers from Russia, or people coming from another country, people coming from the bush, perhaps. So there's no cookie cutter answer, Senator. Your point to, through the chair, is well taken, but I don't know that it does. I defer to the commissioner.
This is Joe Masters, through the chair. The statutes for sex trafficking don't require transportation of a victim from one location to another. It has to do with selling the conduct or the act. So it doesn't have to do with moving somebody across state lines or from one geographic location to another.
So if I may continue, so the Mann Act doesn't necessarily, the Mann Act requires transportation. I just want to be careful or thoughtful about putting a new category for what we're, I think, dealing fairly well with pimps. All right.
Senator Dyson, another question?
Yeah, I'm sorry to continue. Do prostitutes under existing law have to register as sex offenders after they've served their time?
Under existing law, no.
And if I may, but I think pimps do, don't they?
I don't believe they currently do. I believe that we did have a specific recommended change that I believe is one in the bill, the governor's bill.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I think currently, unless there's a sex offense that's directly related that fits into one of the other categories of sexual assault, sexual abuse, things like that, then they would.
Yeah, one more, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
And I would recommend that. You know, a pimp and a trafficker is easily as dangerous as others. The other one, I don't want to play gotcha here, Attorney General, but I was talking with the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and I worked here a few years ago with Ethan Berkowitz, and on most of the stuff that's in our law about restorative justice. Now, it was represented to me that the last three calendar years, the courts assigned roughly $600,000 per year as for restoration. You know, the victim's supposed to do what they could. And in that period, only $40,000 was collected. And there was the implication that it's just not a high priority for who would follow up on that to make sure that that happens, or the best we can in a court system.
Well, there's a Violent Crimes Compensation Board, if you're talking about. I mean, I don't know. I mean, which is there, and I couldn't speak chapter verse if these victims would qualify or not. We also looked at, and what we also found out, there is a civil remedy, and I mean, that they can sue their traffickers as well if they want. If there's some reason to believe that they did it out of their house, maybe their insurance might apply, or they did it out of a storefront. I mean, there's other possibilities, but I don't. I mean, there's a violent crimes compensation board. Whether these victims would qualify, as I sit here, I don't know. Do you know, right, Commissioner? I don't know. I'd have to get back to you.
I just want to respond to that. These were judge-ordered payments. They shouldn't have to go to civil court to collect it. And, you know, the represent to me was that the legal authorities weren't making a high priority of going after the restitution that was court-ordered for the victims.
Well, we, the Department of Law, is responsible now for collecting restitution for victims, and we have money. We do that, and I can,
good,
can give you chapter and verse, and then I can't speak to several years ago when that information was passed, but it's a task that was foisted on us by the court system several years ago, and we don't have electronic alignment. This is another example where we don't have electronic alignment between the court system and the Department of Law to try to electronically transfer information, so we end up having to manually input a lot of stuff, and it's a process that's not very efficient. Senator, I'd be happy to discuss it with you or talk to you more about what we're trying to do and trying to play catch up with it, but it is an issue. But we do it, and it's something we take very seriously because it's other people's money. That's my attitude. It's other people's money. They need to get it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I have one question. I'll go to Gabrielle Adu. One of the things that Commissioner Masters that was brought up is how when you first engage somebody who is a prostitute, how do you get from, you know, the illegal activity to the confidence level to a referral level immediately? That's a cultural change, I would think, within the police force. Help us understand how you see that as something you can work on.
Well, first off, I have to say, Mr. Chairman, that as far as DPS is concerned, we haven't necessarily developed the expertise on this. APD is ahead of us on this. The FBI is ahead of us on this. If you look at certainly the reporting, that was one of the sections in the report Senator Dyson talked about. The virtually AST has done pretty much zero cases in sex trafficking for both the prostitution side and the promoting prostitution side, and that's pretty indicative of an organization that doesn't do proactive enforcement on this type of offense, and that's something that we're working on now. So part of it's recognition that the sex trafficking does occur. Part of it's engaging our workforce in teaching them and instructing them on ways to identify potential victims and how they may be victims, and then incorporate that change of knowledge and how they deal with, in most of these cases, what we're talking about is people that may present themselves as criminals in some of the cases that we're investigating.
Well, one of the problems that I see coming up, and this also for the Attorney General, is if somebody thinks that they're doing it on their own, and they're of a legal age, and they are under coercion, and yet we've got to somehow deal with that. I think that's going to be one of the issues that, involved in legal activity. That's going to be one of the technical legal problems of if they are culpable willingly, and yet they're under duress. We have to get through that somehow, and there's got to be a legal ladder to get us through that. And so I'm sure open to discussion, especially since we have the sex trafficking and assault bill in front of us. It might be something that we can start hammering out in the law that we have. I just wanted to set it up as a thought, and then Gabrielle Adu has a question, and just flag me down if you guys got something. Gabrielle?
Yes. Do you or could you use failure to pay restitution as a parole or a parole violation? Petition for to revoke parole for failure to comply with restitution.
Through the chair, Representative LaDuke, great question. I don't know the answer to that.
You can.
I'll get back to you on that and find out.
Thank you.
I think what you've done is brought up questions that you want to get answered, and it, for everyone that you bring up, we got probably five more, right? So it shows that in this state, we have some unanswered questions, and we have some unhelped victims today. And so I think being deliberate about it is important. I don't think we want to get hasty, but I think we're going to be deliberate. So my compliments to the senator sitting to my right, who kind of kicked this thing in motion to get more information on the table. Intervention then becomes kind of an interesting issue. Getting the confidence of them. But let me ask, excuse me, I got to make sure I get the name Gwen right. Gwen, I think having private parties having access to gaining confidence is a good thing. But one of the questions that we'll have as legislators when it comes down to it is how do we know the right private people are there to get their confidence? And so I think we need to start thinking about what are the decision trees that have to happen to make sure that's a credible source. So from your perspective, how would you describe a recommendation to invite somebody in? And maybe you don't have the answer to that now. Maybe that's a question that you already have. But I can see that's something that we would ask right off the bat. How do we don't create a bigger victim pool and actually provide help? Is that something you've thought about?
Well, a little bit. I think as far as proper training, background checks, and that there is accountability for a victim's advocacy group, whether it's to a task force group that's formed, but somebody knows what's going on and what the training requirements are, background checks, and ongoing training.
I'm very sympathetic with somebody who feels that they're under entrapment. And I've known people in my own life who had been victimized for a lot of years and felt that if they said anything, nobody would believe them. So first of all, I think there's family reporting, there's the encouragement to be bold and step out. But I suppose going to the police or the health and social services is the first big barrier, right? To go to somebody that will understand and then put you safely somewhere. Or help you be safe. So maybe I should have the Health and Social Services come up here. And maybe, Ree, if you wouldn't mind coming up here, with all the various different agencies we have here. Senator Dyson and I talked years and years ago about somebody being able to pick up the phone and not have to look through 14 pages of blue numbers to find, and 211 was the number that finally came up, and we're actually beginning that process. If they found out that they could dial 211, who would they go to, and what would be the response today?
Let me make sure I understand the question. So if 211 received a call, what would they do with the caller in terms of referring them?
They have a neighbor who's, let's just say, who's 13 years old, who is being enslaved by Uncle Joe, right? And she just needs to get out of there. And it's either suicide or call somebody, because that's kind of probably going to be where they end up. So she says, okay, I heard about 211 in school. Mm-hmm. She picks up 211 and says, I need help. What happens from there?
Well, 211, Senator Coghill, 211 is an emerging, very valuable tool for information and referral in the state. It's becoming increasingly robust. And one of the things that we've done is all of our grantees are required to essentially register their information with 211 so that they're in the index of help available throughout the state. This was also a topic that the task force talked about in terms of an 800 line, and whether it was the one that's national or whether we should have a specifically devoted one in the state or whether or not we could piggyback on the 211 system. And I don't think we came to a final decision, but we know that that capacity needs to be here. I think the other more meaty part of your question is, do we have sufficient resources for 211 to refer to? And I think there are a huge number of resources out there, but I'm not convinced that they are coordinated and focused in a way that they can bring a focused response to this type of victim. Many of the clients who are served by many of the resources out there have characteristics similar to what you would find in trafficking victims. And many of the people who are getting served in our systems are the victims of trafficking. But we might not know that on the surface of it. But whether or not we can come up with a conscious, coordinated reaction and design of treatment, if you wish, that's multifaceted, that's coordinated, and delivered timely, I don't think we're there yet.
Well, I know of at least one agency, one group, I should say, and I think there's many others like this particular one, called, it's an international group that restores women from sex trafficking, and it's called, I'm going to pre-senior you a moment, it'll come up here in a minute. But there are people that do that already, but the state would be the first one, if they're going to arrest them, to be able to refer them. So what you're saying right now is if this young 13, 14-year-old picked up the phone, probably most likely would dial 911, not 211, would be my guess. And the 911 people would do what? Send them to a hospital?
Call the cops.
Would call the cops?
Call the cops. And I think 211, you know, the way we've tried to watch it expand is they would be more likely to say, do you need food assistance? Do you need housing assistance? And sort of click down a list of inquiries that talks about what's the list of needs you're looking for, and then refer them to the agencies who might have that assistance for them. But like I said, whether or not all of that gets coordinated, well, I don't think so. At this point.
So just so that you know that my senior moment wasn't total lapse. It was it's Shared Hope International. It's one of the groups that I've supported down through the years. And they do that. They actually will go out and rescue people out of prostitution. They will restore them, and then they'll put them in rehabilitation. And it's something that that youngsters need to know that's there. I don't think the state could do it as good as a group that is so committed, like a faith-based group. We would be able to probably make sure that there's legal avenues they could go through, and that's one of the things I'll be interested in.
Yeah.
But there are groups out there. Did you, Ted, to go out and catalog those that are advocacy groups in this particular area?
I'm not sure if we have the list of advocacy groups per se. And I also think that there is a special type of expertise that needs to be deployed with the needs of these people. And that's what I think that coordinating role is one for these experts to play in the system.
So there was a Mary Magdalene Center in Anchorage. Is that still in operation? Do you know? It is? All right.
Yeah.
Those are some resources. And what I'm trying to get at is, I know there are youngsters, and maybe even watching this program, who are saying, you know, somebody's talking about me, I'm still entrapped, I need to get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wouldn't want them to think that this meeting is just talking about the problem, but that if they had a need, at least the Mary Magdalene Center, the Shared Hope International, what could the state at this point provide, you know?
I think that also goes to the need to educate the public more. The fact that a child would be in that situation is, you know, under these circumstances, that would be child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we delineate that there's trafficking over here and child abuse over here, they are one and the same, in terms of maltreatment to children, and that opens up a
so dialing 911 is at least the first and proper response.
911 or 211,
right?
Yeah.
Get me help. Right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, one of the recommendations Commissioner Masters touched on would be a high-profile media campaign coming up with some tasteful, well-done ads. I mean, these victims may sit around and watch a lot of TV, and showing that somebody, in a similar situation, and showing that there's hope and posting the number out there. Maybe it's 211. To take away the emergency element from it, but let them know that there's a voice out there that's specifically tailored to their situation. And that's the purpose of our one of the earlier recommendations we made about, which is trying to give this much more awareness out to the public on TV. That takes money, and they've got to be, and it has a message, and it's tastefully done, effectively done. I'm not an expert in that by any means,
and
it just touches back on that, what I think you're saying.
Attorney General, I know of women who also have been led into addiction substances and then willingly sold themselves for the drugs, and yet knew that was not the life they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they got into it, then it became a different entrapment. So knowing that drug rehab is available and that they can actually escape those, but then they have a real legal battle on their hands at that point, because the people who've been selling drugs are going to be very, very concerned. Certainly those that she is willing to sold herself to probably is not going to be as big a deal, but now the drug ring is probably the bigger deal. What kind of resources, if a 20-year-old girl is caught up, or a 20-year-old guy is caught up in that, and he said or she said, I want out today, they don't dial 911 very easily, because they're going to have people selling them drugs that are interested in their income level going away. What can they do at this point?
Well, beyond we do identify in the report, Mr. Chairman, all the non-governmental organizations that we contacted, beginning on page 8, and what they provide, and we also talk about a table on page 10 showing the services are provided. I don't have. There is an 800 number offered through this Polaris project that was referenced earlier, but again, I'm not sure how well known that is or what website. So, we've got a lot of work to do in this, and I don't have any silver bullets and direct entry. You mentioned something that I do want to touch on, which is another side of this project, which is the demand side. I mean, the reason this exists is because there's Johns out there who are willing to pay for this, and they've committed they allow this abuse and entrapment to continue and nourish it and encourage it. So that's also going to be part of the function, and it's one of the recommendations we didn't touch on today, but it's touched on in there, what they call John schools, other cities have done. San Francisco's got a deal like this. So again, we're going after the demand side of this, not just, we need to help victims, no question, but the people who do this, create a demand for this industry, need to be prosecuted. It's against the law.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I know this is, I don't want to be, go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Just state your name again for
me. Gwen Adams. One of the things that we found that I think came up over and over again in the task force is there are some great organizations around the state, some great nonprofits that do provide a number of services. There's legal services, there's free doctors, and there's doctors that will offer pro bono, lawyers that will do the same. But we have a glaring lack of networking.
Yes.
And so that is something that we would hope would be a big deal for a continued task force to address.
As a matter of fact, that was one of the questions that was brought up. Who helps these folks, because they're generally not able to get the legal help that they deserve to find their way through a system that is really not accommodating to them?
Well, this is Gwen again. That would be one of the things that a victims advocacy group, they would know what resources are available, have a checklist. If one of the things that we had talked about, if you an alternative program to going to jail would be to step on board with something, but you would be required to check into drug rehab if that was needed, get a doctor's appointment and see what's going on physically. So there's a checklist that victims advocate could provide that kind of run a victim through a system and getting some of those helps and supports to them.
Oh, yes.
Gwen, if I could, you gave two compelling stories. How did you learn about the situation? Was it in the context of a victims advocacy group? I mean, how did you, would they come to you for help? I mean, just for interest.
Well, one of them I had heard through the grapevine that she had faced this horrific abuse of sex trafficking. So I had tried to contact her to see if she would come in and talk with me, and she said, no way. About 6 months later, I got a call, and she said, I can't take it anymore. I know too many women in my situation. I need to talk. So she came in and told her story that way. The other one, like I said, was in a class that I was teaching, and she would come and ask questions or maybe even ask for prayer, and things just weren't adding up. So I finally pulled her in my office, shut the door, and said, start talking. And little by little, the story came out.
Senator McGuire, and then Senator Dyson.
Yeah, just a couple questions. One comment first, which is that I don't know if you guys looked at this, but Alaska Legal Services, one of the reasons I always support Alaska Legal Services, and just to remind colleagues, they always have a line item in the budget, is because they do help a lot of victims of domestic violence, and I assume this would be an area I'll talk with them, but they might be able to take on more of these victims. It looks like in your report that when you went into rural Alaska, you say a lot of the majority of NGOs in rural Alaska had not, to the best of their knowledge, assisted any victims in sex trafficking or human trafficking. And I guess what I wanted to know was they hadn't assisted, but is that because there wasn't an issue? My understanding is there is an issue, and as you pointed out, Gwen, so artfully, that there's an issue because there is a disproportionately high percentage of sexual abuse already, and because of the particular ethnic look, and that often rural Alaskan young people are sought because then they're displaced and it's very difficult to return them to, they have to get a plane ticket and things like that. So I guess what I'm trying to understand there is why hadn't those NGOs in rural Alaska assisted victims, and what do we do for rural Alaska there?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, if Michelle, if you're still online, would you mind responding to that?
Yes, I'm still on the line.
Did you hear the senator's question about the NGOs in rural Alaska at least have not knowingly treated a number of victims of trafficking yet? As we pointed out, they're likely to be happening out there, but so it's not being reported. But could you comment on that, please, Michelle, from your perspective?
Yes, I'll be happy to comment on that, and I did hear the discussion. I feel fairly strongly that organizations in rural Alaska are serving survivors of trafficking, and they're doing so not knowing that they're doing so. As I mentioned earlier, my participation on the task force brought forward both people who had experienced trafficking and disclosed that to me and my organization, but also many concerned friends and family members who spoke about loved ones who they believe were recruited into trafficking in Anchorage specifically. So that brought to light the fact that I think we're not identifying people who've experienced trafficking as that. I think folks are presenting as domestic violence victims typically, perhaps sometimes as sexual assault victims. But I think when folks are getting services from an agency like mine or an organization like mine or other service type organizations, they're not initially identifying as trafficking victims. And we learned from the presentations that we received that people often don't don't see themselves as victims of trafficking until they're much farther along in the and out of it and out of that situation, because they see themselves as complicit with what's happening. And that's where we got to that recommendation of putting some questions into intake materials at grant-funded organizations and into a couple of those larger surveys that get done, because I feel strongly, based on the testimony that we did hear, that we are in fact serving folks who have experienced or are experiencing trafficking, and we're not asking the right questions of those folks.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Michelle, thank you. And that goes to the intake instrument that you were talking about that you originally brought up. And it also kind of talks about the trauma-informed care that, so from the instrument to the care. And then for the public safety, it sounds to me like the new way of thinking is domestic assault quite often is not just the primary issue here. You might have primary, secondary, and other issues. So then it's a matter of how to look beyond kind of the first report problem, right? And so that's going to be an interesting change of mindset. And I think with all of us here, that's probably been the hardest thing for us, too, because we hear the social service world talk to us in their budget language, and then we hear the public safety talk to us in their language, and then we hear these issues come before, and we really have to make sense of it as what is our delivery of service system. And I meant it when I said, if somebody's there today, we wouldn't want this conversation to fall totally deaf and say, you know, they're going to talk about it for another 10 years and I'm still stuck here, you know. So I wanted to give at least a question on that account. And then there are actually social service agencies out there that will help. Then it's just a matter of making sure that when they do, we don't beat them down because they do. And I think that's probably one of the questions. And I think the intake instruments become kind of one of the key elements then, is the first thing you start talking to them. So we're down to the last 2 minutes. I think maybe Attorney General, Max Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you folks were talking, I got thinking that a lot of these crimes are organizational crimes. They involve a lot of people in them. And I looked at our conspiracy statutes, and AS 120 only covers human trafficking in the first degree and sex trafficking in the first degree. And I want to focus on that under 1166.110.
Max, we are out of time, and so. I'm sorry, the timing just couldn't have been worse on that, because I think you're bringing up a good point.
The question was going to be, should we expand conspiracy to cover sex trafficking in the second degree, at least certain types of it? Somebody can get an answer to the committee.
Point well taken. Actually, both of us as committees are dealing with the sex trafficking and human trafficking and sexual assault bill in committee. So I wouldn't mind if you gave me that reference again by way of note or email.
And I also looked up, tried to find out the answer to Representative Ledoux's question. And in certain cases, they could do a petition to revoke.
Attorney General,
what I was doing.
Commission members, thank you very much. Last word, 1 minute.
I just appreciate the opportunity to present the report today.
Well, thank you for listening to our Alaskans. Thank you for coming to us with a recommendation. I expect that we'll take it very seriously, and hopefully we'll come out with another look at this thing. First thing is we need to get the law that you've proposed as a administration before us. But for those who have listened to Alaskans and who are still now helping Alaskans, and young people and older people who are under a condition they just can't get out of, my gratitude, and we'll work on it post-haste. Thank you.
We look forward to working with the committee.
We're adjourned.